and welcome to episode 119 of the Planning Period Podcast, part of the On Podcast Media Network. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Blair Mishlow and John Spike. Blair and John are both specialists with digital and distance learning. I reached out to them and asked if they would like to join me to discuss the face of education now and what this could mean for the future of the education space. This is an uncertain time for a lot of us, so I wanted to get some big picture ideas, but also some concrete things to bring directly into your distance learning classroom right away. And I think our conversation did that. John, Blair, and I talk about the differences between blended models and fully online and distance learning, the importance of letting go of time in online learning, building community, how to balance the amount of work you give to students, why all teachers need to give themselves some space to fail, what the elimination of standardized tests means in the future, and how online learning could take over if districts don't prepare. So sit back and enjoy episode 119 of the Planning Period Podcast, the Distance Learning Panel. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your host, as always, Brad Schreffler. And, it is a bit of a new world in education right now. I think everybody knows that. That's not a surprise to anybody, as the coronavirus, COVID-19, has swept this our world as a whole and caused a lot of us to go to distance learning sort of quickly. A lot of planes being built in the air, it feels like, in education right now. And so I reached out to a couple people and said, hey, I'd love to talk a little bit about this and think about what this looks like and what it should look like. And so I reached out to my buddy, John Spike. How you doing, man?
I am wonderful. Great to be on the show again, Brad.
Absolutely. It's great to have you back. And Blair Mishlow, also former guest of the show. How are you doing?
You know, I'm surprisingly well, considering everything in the world.
And so I figured we could take some time today to just sort of chat about distance learning and where education is, where we want it to go, and where it might end up as this all goes. We'll do one at a time, just quick intros to who you are if people don't know you, and sort of maybe emphasize a little bit your position with distance learning and what your input there might be. So, John, you want to kick us off?
All right, sounds good. So my name is John Spike, and I started my career as a high school English teacher and then moved into a K-12 tech coaching role, working with teachers on how to, you know, implement digital strategies into their teaching. And then my most recent job is coordinator of instructional technology and integration services in the College of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And basically my role there is to work with staff and then future teachers on using technology in their roles. And then my real experience with online teaching came, I got my master's from Marion University, and I actually was asked after I graduated to teach courses online for their master's program. And so I actually taught a course online called Teaching and Learning Online. And so can you imagine they decided to teach that one, fully online? Kind of makes sense when you think about it. But that's my background. I've been teaching online and blended for the last 5 years. And then I teach courses at the university as well, a course called Digital Tools for Pre-Service Librarians, and then another course called Video Games and Learning, which we teach blended for undergrads going into education or game design.
Perfect. Yeah, I've always been fascinated by your video games and learning course. Every time you talk about it, I'm like, that just sounds like so much fun. I want to take that.
It's pretty popular with the students too. I like to think we never have a problem filling out that course. I'll just put it that way.
That works. All right, and Blair, what about you?
Yeah, so I entered the classroom through Teach for America. I spent 5 years teaching in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and in Washington, D.C. And when I lived in DC, I did an education innovation fellowship. So I really started to explore like the possibility specifically around like working towards educational equity, how ed tech and personalized learning and online learning, when implemented well, can really help move the needle towards educational equity. And then after I left the classroom, I was a director of personalized learning for a school in Phoenix, and I still work for them part-time remotely. So I honestly, like, in terms of like strictly online learning, I have limited experience in it. And I have a lot of experience in terms of broader digital learning. So when the school closure started to be announced, the school in Phoenix asked if I could lead the charge in terms of creating their virtual remote distance learning plan. And honestly, I'm leaning heavily on my background in digital learning, but I still have plenty of room to go in terms of growing my skills. So it's an interesting time where I'm growing my skills kind of rapidly. And I'm also like the person who knows the most within the school that I'm helping. So it's a weird juxtaposition because I know that I have a lot of room for growth and I know that like I'm leading this thing. So I'm trying to balance like being transparent and honest and vulnerable of like, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm watching five webinars a day and like contacting a lot of humans. And also like leaning into my expertise because I know a decent amount. So it's been an interesting couple of weeks to say the least.
Yeah. You know, I think I want to start there because that is one of the things I'm feeling a lot of right now. And as the digital coach at my school and one of few on-site digital coaches in our district, I feel like they are very much leaning on me to help support. And I have experience with blended and using technology in a classroom. And while that does transition and relate on some level to distance learning, I feel like there's probably some drastic differences that I really need to be considering and I'm not. And yet I am being very much looked at as the person to help. And I don't feel like I have all the answers. So much like you, Blair, that transparency of I'm not positive, I haven't used this tool in this way, I think it will work. You know, a lot of questions I keep getting is, will they be able to do this at home? I hope. I don't know if that system requires the district network. I'm not positive. I think that I want to start there. And maybe I'll ask you, John, what are sort of the big differences in your mind between fully distanced online learning and a blended model?
Yeah, I guess with a blended model, and I have this conversation with a lot of staff members at you know, UW-Whitewater, the K-12 schools I've worked at. I really feel like all of our face-to-face classes have become blended classrooms, honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, really what we do, we've got LMSs and we're looking at giving students opportunity to demonstrate their learning outside of the classroom walls and connect them, you know, with other, you know, subject matter experts and authentic audiences. Like just because we are in the brick and mortar school doesn't mean we're already not in a blended classroom. So I would argue a blended classroom, we're seeing it, you know, when we go to our K-12 and our higher ed institutions. The online, really all we've done is we've pulled that brick and mortar requirement. And another, I think, key thing that really is important is I've seen so many posts about Zoom and Google Hangouts Meet and all these things, but really in a true online, you don't need to necessarily have that synchronous. And a lot of people sign up for online because they can't commit to a synchronous. And so I think one thing we have to free ourselves of is the idea that we have to be right there with our learners at every step. If anything, we just need to empower ourselves to still create a sense of community in an online without feeling like I need to see you at this time. I think we need to get over that time-bound nature because that's really been key. With all the online courses I've taken, they've made it available to do synchronous, but they've said, we want to empower you to use any tools at your disposal to facilitate learning from me, learning from each other, but we don't want to say you have to be here now because we know you have drastically different lives. So I guess that's a big difference for me is we're living in the blended teaching world, whether we accept it or not. But that online world is we really need to pull off that restriction of time and more think about the activities we're doing.
This is something that has been coming up at a lot of the sites I'm helping and along with a lot of people I'm helping in a constant discussion on some of these teacher Facebook groups is like everybody keeps asking, well, how do we take attendance? And every time I just say, you're asking the wrong question. Like this isn't like, and I'm trying to be, you know, polite about it because I understand they're trying to keep some normalcy for their own structures, right? This is the rug just got yanked out from under all of our teachers and they're freaking out and they're trying to find that piece of normalcy and even justifying it by saying it gives normalcy to the students, something they're used to. But at the same time, this is a totally different world. And I, to me, I go back to Blair, the equity component of, if I've got a high school kid who is raising his three younger siblings now because his mom's still got to work, even though they're not going to school, I can't expect that high school kid to be on at 11 o'clock because his little sister wants lunch right then. And he might get on, and I can't even expect him to get on every day. He might get on Wednesdays on the day his mom doesn't work so that she can watch the kids and he can take the entire week's worth of work on Wednesday. And why would I punish that if they're learning? So I feel like this equity component wraps directly into that asynchronous mindset.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's a lot that I don't know. And like something I like created a webinar last week, I think, about online learning, just because so many folks were reaching out about it. And the three tenets, especially in the context of, because I think something that's been missing from a lot of the many, many emails that everyone has gotten about like how this edtech company is handling coronavirus. And I, the context that's been missing is like online learning in the context of a pandemic that is stressful and also was not well planned. Like we did not have time to plan around it. So I've created like three kind of like guiding principles that I've been following. And I'd actually like in real time, love feedback from y'all if you have any, because this is like what I've been using as folks have reached out. But the first is just providing stability, which includes that access component. It does include like habituating routines and expectations and traditions, but not because you've always like attendance would not kind of fall under that, but maybe do we, if you traditionally do like a shout out in your classroom every day, you can still do that virtually. And that's actually a great way to provide stability because it is a system that kids know. The second principle is sustaining relationships. And then the third is exploring innovative tools in service of supporting kids. So that's kind of what I've been using to guide me as I try to navigate like all of the things that are coming at teachers and folks in our position around, you know, resource roundups and tools you can use and email blasts. I've been trying to keep those three principles kind of front of mind because I have noticed that a lot of companies maybe are not doing that.
And I think not, like you said, not only companies not doing it, when I see, you know, I've got a lot of people forwarding me things at this point, and I'm getting emails forwarded to me from principals at other sites, and they're going, is this really what I should be doing? And I'm going, no, it's really, really not. It's not at all. You know, and I think talking about that first point about maintaining routines in the right ways, right? I think that's so critical. And like you said, attendance is a mechanism that can cause punishment, right? It can be a negative mechanism if we're requiring attendance, but a daily shout out of a student, that is not a negative mechanic, right? Like that's a positive mechanic. I think, like you said, that's a good idea. If that's something I did before, then yeah, I should keep doing that. Some of those routines, you know, another one I keep seeing, and back to EdTech about routines, is there's a lot of back and forth of like, which tool should I use? Should I go to, you know, we have our LMS's Canvas, but then people are like, well, Google Classroom they're saying is better. And then they're like, well, but Canvas is better. And I'm like, okay, well, yes, but if you've been using Google Classroom this whole time, don't switch now, because that's what your kids are used to. But if you've tried nothing, then yeah, try the one that's better. Like some of that is like, there's not a one size fits all. So I think it's maintaining the routines that work for your kids in your classroom. And that's like that third point you said, trying something new is still for the benefit of servicing students. Mm-hmm. John, would you say we're on the right track here?
Well, yeah, I'm going to just put your mind at ease here, Blair. I think those are three great tenets. The number one out of what you're talking about is that relationships. We always call it community building. That is the most important part of online teaching, is it is going to be so much harder to maintain community. And the number one reason that students burn out of an online class is they don't feel connected to their instructor or to their fellow students. And I've taken online courses, thankfully there are few and far between, where I was never asked to interact with anyone. I didn't know what anybody looked like, what they did. And then I had courses where I probably knew too much about, you know, my fellow classmates. We were doing constant projects with them. We were encouraged to talk. My instructor was very open, and my instructor was authentic, you know, would just do the web, you know, when they do an optional synchronous webinar, it was in somewhere, you know, laid back, you know, in their living room, they were hair tousled. They didn't look like they, you know, top half was business suit and bottom half was PJs, right? They just were them, you know? And, yeah. And that's huge. I think your three tenets are great. And the number one that I'll always circle people back to is, how are you creating community? Are you just doing a fun video? Like you said, the shout outs, I would just give out a chintzy award in my online classes to adults studying who are full-timers. And I just give shout outs each week, who nailed the discussions, who nailed the assignment. And then I'd throw out, like, I had one, I gave a shout out. One woman shared in a discussion post, she was pregnant. And I threw out, she gets the creating human life award for the week, you know? And it was just something stupid and funny. I think I had the scene from Lion King where, you know, they're holding up Simba on Pride Rock and it's just like dumb stuff like that. You know, it's just ways to keep that community alive rather than just a robotic to-do list. Right. And I think that's the key thing is the relationship building, but all three of your tenants are absolutely spot on.
Yay. I mean, I didn't think that we were like running in the opposite direction, but it's really hard to know because there are like I've gotten so many emails and it is overwhelming because it's Brad, exactly like you mentioned. I'm like, should we do Canvas? Should we do Slack now? Zoom versus Google Hangouts Meet. And I'm trying to keep my mind focused on those tenants because those are unwavering. You can meet them via multiple tools, but it's been hard to not go down a rabbit hole of, well, which reading tool should we use? Let me spend all this time on it.
So, John, if we're focusing on building communities in our online environments, especially, and again, this is new territory for everybody, but especially when we are changing paths middle of the road, right? Like, I mean, we're in the middle of a thing and all of a sudden this is totally different now. What are maybe some key things to do and maybe key things not to do in terms of community building that teachers should be thinking about if they're starting online learning on Monday, for example?
Yeah. One thing that I think is really important is giving your students different ways to engage with the community. You know, some of them are not really going to, especially if you're switching tack very quickly, some of them, their only interaction with a discussion forum maybe previous to this is what they saw in the forums for their favorite video game, or maybe what they've seen in YouTube comments. And one thing my wife and I discovered when we taught this Minecraft summer school course, and we had the students just plan out like their societies in a discussion forum on Google Classroom. They'd never used one before and they treated each other like garbage. And we realized they needed a whole training into how to have online discourse. So one thing that is really important.
Wait, are you saying they're not supposed to talk like YouTube comments?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that wild? We had to train them up into how to interact in an online platform. So you might have that with students and because they're at a distance, it's much easier for them to, you know, be sarcastic or say things that they're joking, but nobody picks up on that. So if you can have differentiated ways, you know, the soup du jour right now, of course, is Flipgrid, you know, to give them a chance to face-to-face share what's going on, their thoughts, but give them varied ways to engage in the community, whether it is just sending a fun picture of what they're doing, a video response, an audio, or a text if they want to engage in a forum, but let them have a voice in the class. Let them share it out with the students if they're comfortable, you know, no mandatory, but hey, if you're comfortable putting it out there, this is a space that you have, and trying to empower and acknowledge that, you know, when you do if you do a weekly update webinar, that's optional, shout out things you noticed from that space you've given them, and honor those voices and acknowledge it, because that goes a long way. Just acknowledging a voice or an opinion or just a fun thing they're doing is a great way to do that. So I would say a do is, you know, give them multiple ways to contribute. And then I guess a don't is just assume, you know, put these strict ground rules in, like you must post one topic to this and you must reply to two peers, like must just feel like it's forced conversation rather than authentic. Mm-hmm. I want to encourage my students and each other. And again, we get back to that. Well, I take attendance. I have to do this. Well, I expect participation. We're in a different world. We're in uncharted territory. So having those must-dos, not as practical as here's a space. I'd love to hear about your thoughts on this and really turning the conversation to, I know you're missing this engagement with each other. Like, you know, here's a space for you to do it.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I think that's good. And like you said, the multiple modes of participation, I think, is great. And the face-to-face video component, like you said, also can help with some of those, you know, behavioral qualms. And it is harder to insult someone when they've posted a video. And especially now, it'll be a classmate they already know, right? It's not a YouTuber who's not a real person. It's a classmate that they've been in school with since August. It's totally different, I think, in that space, and that will help mitigate some of those responses, I think. So yeah, I like that. That's solid. I think that's good stuff. You know, one of the concerns I have right now is sort of with the speed of all this, as especially in secondary and somewhat in elementary, but especially in secondary, I'm concerned about teachers overloading students with work. Thinking about, well, on a normal day, I would have them for 50 minutes. So I'm going to give, you know, a 20-minute lecture or a 10-minute lecture even, and then 40 minutes of work. And as we know, teachers are notoriously bad about timing things and thinking it's going to take 40 and it takes an hour and a half and things like that. Is that a concern you guys have thought of? And maybe how are you thinking of addressing it with staff, or maybe a best practice for amount of time to assume? Blair, you want to start us off? You're developing the digital plan for a school. Let's get us kicked off.
So that's been something that's like been in the back of my mind right now. To be frank, like, I'm worried about teachers not planning enough. because my school initially, we were on spring break last week, and then we decided to extend spring break another week. So right now, kids and staff, technically speaking, are still on break. and it's been a concern just because we haven't added any planning days before kids come back. So, well, for teachers themselves, we've been planning a lot. So something that I've been like, we've built a school-wide model that's going out to all kids. It's playlist-based. So I don't know how familiar you are with playlists. John, you look familiar. Brad, are you familiar?
I think I know where you're going with playlists, but I think a quick definition for the listeners, just to confirm my suspicions.
Yeah. So a playlist-based model gives students some choice or voice. Kind of, there's a bunch of different names for it. You could call it like a menu or a board, but students are essentially, and there's a bunch of ways to build them, but they're given some options, and then they, kind of like a music playlist, you work through it, and maybe for some activities you hit the skip button because it's an activity that you don't want to do, but there's some mechanism to meet a threshold. So the playlist that we're building, students are asked to earn 25 points in a day. But the accountability measure is spread out over the week. So if students earn, Brad, to your point, if they earn maybe 100 points on Wednesday and the rest of the week they can only log on for a few minutes, they're not going to be punished for that. So it's really between Monday and Friday, can you get to X? 25 times 5, that's what, 120?
125,
that sounds right. Yeah. I can do math. So within that, students have a lot of flexibility in terms of when they complete activities and which activities to complete, and they have different point values. So logging on to Khan Academy for 15 minutes might count for 1 point, but meeting with their teacher or completing a ed puzzle that their teacher assigned is worth 5 points. So the reason why I provided all that context is I think that the framework will help teachers to not overplan, because they know that their students have something to work on. They have a playlist, and teachers kind of, the way, and you know, we'll see how it goes, but the way it's set up right now is that teachers get to kind of plug in no more than 3 items that students work on per day. And the rest is ed tech programs that teachers can assign content for, but they can't, it's automatically time boxed. Like, students completing a no red ink activity is like 2 points, and a teacher can't say, oh no, you need to do 5 of them. Like, nope, we've decided as a school that a no red ink activity is like, will take about this much time and it's worth about this much effort in terms of points. So I'm hopeful that that will help teachers not overload. I have had some teachers ask if they can make a whole playlist just for their kids. And the short answer is no. Like, you can give kids choice and be like, to earn your science points, you can do one of these five activities. And I guess that's kind of a playlist, but like, you're not going to give a kid a whole playlist and be like, yep, this is your activity for science today. Because Brad, to your point, that would take hours and would really monopolize that student's attention in terms of, because my school's grade 7 through 12. So kiddos are in a variety of different content areas. So yeah, and I can report back, you know, that might be more of an issue than I think it is. But I'm hoping that teachers will like see, and we've used playlists before, so this is a pre-existing model that teachers are familiar with. And I'm hoping that they will kind of see like where their content falls in to this broader structure.
I was going to say, I'm glad you pointed out that you've done this before. Cause like the metaphor of building the plane in the air. And I feel like you're also trying to build a spaceship on top of the plane while you're doing it. I was like, this seems like a lot. But if there's something they're familiar with, then again, going back to that routine that's beneficial, then yeah, I think that's a good way to balance it. You know, for me, for our school situation, you know, our teachers, a middle school student has 7 teachers a day typically. And I'm just worried that, and you know, even if 3 of the 7 give too much work, that's quickly going to eat into their day, you know, and we all know it just like it takes different amounts of time for different students. And so we've kind of been roughly saying, okay, instead of thinking of doing 50 minutes or 45 minutes of content every day, think more like 30 a day and maybe only 4 days a week instead of 5. Like that's kind of the rough idea we've been giving them, but I don't, you know, again, like you said, I can hopefully know better on Monday if this is actually going to work, right? Like, so John, what do you think?
Yeah. Just a couple of things stood out, during that conversation. One thing, just since you just brought it up, Brad, is one thing you have to think about is these students didn't really sign up to be online learners, right? That's oftentimes a very intentional choice that somebody makes. And now we took the structure of the brick and mortar school, that very rigid structure for the most part, unless you've got kind of more of a avant-garde school, if you will, but we've taken that rigid structure and now they're home. We don't know if, you know, if they've got a parent guardian situation that maintains a structure for them. We don't know if it's kind of free for all. We don't know if mom and dad are too, you know, occupied or whatever the parent guardian situation is, where they can maintain that, yes, 50 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it is. So you really do have to consider that, you know, they may or may not be engaging with the content as long as you're expecting. I mean, that's just true. And the older you get too, you mentioned thinking about, you know, the secondary ed. The other thing you got to think of too is, I love Blair, the playlist or the choice board or the tic-tac-toe, or, you know, people are doing a lot of different ways. I like the, like you've kind of intentionally planned the sequencing and they can skip out. But the other thing too, is you find as they get older, depending on too how the culture of, you know, your, the class and the district and things like that, a lot of times those secondary students will look for the quickest path to completing the assessment, right? They'll only access the resources that they need to get it done, right? So that's something you need to think about. How are you designing the activity that assesses their knowledge? How are you designing it in a way that maybe encourages them to engage with things you have? And the other thing I'd say too, that's really important, is keep in mind now at school, we, for the most part, try to limit these other distractors. And now all the distractors are there, right? Siblings, Netflix, video games. I'm just listing now basically everything that would distract me, right? But
just listing what I've done for the last week. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I haven't done any work. I've just sat around and played games.
Yeah, so. So there's all these distractors. And so now how is your content going to win out over these distractors? So you have to get a little creative. And I'll give you an example. I'm in an online, fully online, you know, a doctoral program. And we had the greatest assignment last week, 2 weeks ago. They're all blending together. But anyways, we were asked to actually listen to a podcast where these different experts argued about whether smart technology was making us dumb or not. And so the assessment here was to, you know, justify a position related to the efficacy of smart technologies and their use in human performance technology. But we did it in a really interesting medium where we had to consider these arguments and decide how our overall topic of human performance technology engaged with the opinions found in a podcast. And so leveraging just a unique platform like a podcast, a student could download that in 5 minutes and then listen to it offline when they don't have access. You know, there's a good chance that a lot of our secondaries have phones or you know, they could acquire something, they could listen to it. But I just thought it was clever trying something different instead of article, video. Here's a podcast where we've got these subject matter experts that aren't me. They're probably going to get sick of you as the teacher at some point during this extended break, right? Not that that would ever happen face to face, but you know, they might get a little sick of you. And just thinking outside the box and what activities you have them do, you know, just changing it up even and finding something different in terms of a medium might help them, you know, be a little less, tempted by the millions of other things that could tempt them.
Yeah. You know, that extra distraction component is interesting because I hadn't really, and I guess I considered that in terms of the access, you know, but even your best students and as someone who teaches at a one-to-one school, on your best students on an average day can get distracted by what their laptops can do. And that's when it's on a filtered home connection at the school that's blocking even more things than it's going to be at home. Like there's a whole new layer of problems added onto that. So yeah, that's it. That's a really good point. You know, it's a lot. You know, the one thing I want to say is we're covering all this, right? I think, and even like you said, Blair, like we can report on Monday. I think a lot of us are going to be reporting on Monday that things didn't work, right? Like, and I think we need to allow that a little bit. I think we need to model that growth mindset, to use a good educational buzzword, that we expect out of our students in ourselves at this point. This was not something we had nearly enough time to plan for. You know, this isn't something that we saw coming necessarily, although, you know, you could make an argument we probably should have, but we definitely are doing the best we can right now. And I think that's what we should be asking, to do the best we can, not the best, right? I think that's something that I would like to stress to anybody listening. And if you guys, either one of you want to weigh in on that, welcome to jump in on that one.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something my principal said that kind of put me at ease. Like, I was running through, you know, I spent many hours building this plan that is, you know, riding on a lot of unknown variables. And, you know, principals are in positional power, right? Because, like, he's my boss and also someone I look up to and a mentor. And he said, you know, you've thought about everything that we possibly could have, and anything we haven't, any problems we run into, is it because we did something wrong? It's because we haven't been through this before. And that's a really simple thing to say, but it really put me at ease because it's like, oh yeah, like, I don't know. Like, I painted a room the other day, and that's something that I've done, you know, 10 times in my life. And I knew to put down drop cloths because inevitably I would spill, which I did a lot of paint. But I didn't get the paint on the carpet because I've painted before and I've spilled things on carpets and been yelled at by my parents. And, this is not something we've gone through. And even for those of us who have led online experiences before, we've never done it in this context with such little planning. And, so I like, you know, I think being generous with ourselves is really important. Not just for our own well-being, but so that we can like dust ourselves off when something goes wild and come back and make it better for our kids.
Yeah. I just want to echo Blair's sentiments there. And one thing that I've found helps in a lot of different contexts, not just like this shift to online, is language matters and how you talk about this with your students as the instructor. A trick that I've taken out of a book, it's called Intention, Critical Creativity in the Classroom, from Amy Burville and Dan Ryder. I had to look it up quick, so I'm looking off on my other screen here. But they had this great tip that was, make sure you're always framing your students in the way you want them to think of themselves. And so one thing I did in a course this fall with that advice in mind from them was I always called them in their groups. I didn't call them groups or anything. I called them design teams, because they had these design challenges. I wanted them to always think of themselves, you're a design team, you're in competition with these other design teams. I tried to be very intentional with that language. And I think being intentional right now is really key. You know, tell your students they are beta testers in the next great, you know, online learning course. And beta testers, the important thing they do is they give feedback and they try to improve the product. So you can let them know they are helping improve, you know, maybe not call it a product. That sounds bad in K-12 if we refer to our course as a product. But, you know, tell them they're beta testers in this great new experience that you're trying to build, and ask for their feedback, and let them know you are on the front lines of giving feedback that will influence this for years to come. And I think being intentional about how you address them, you know, and I know it sounds cheesy, you know, like we call our second graders explorers, or at least that's what I was called when I was in my second grade. But even just, I felt like from one year to the next, I didn't do too much different in my group projects, but just me hammering home, they're a design team that's designing things they will use, helped. Mm-hmm. And I think if we tell our students they are the guinea pigs, not so much, but you know, beta testers, and letting them know that this is going to always be in beta for the rest of the semester. I mean, it's just the way it is. This is going to be a constant beta product. And we might not ever get to the final release for the public, but you know, that you're willing to be flexible and you value what they tell you about your online, I think is really crucial. And just being humble about it. We didn't plan to teach online like this. It was thrust upon us, but you know, that's how greatness is made, when it's thrust upon you. That sounded really cheesy. We can cut this, right, Brad?
We wouldn't expect anything less from you, John. Wouldn't expect anything less.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you talked about how this was thrust upon us, and we are in beta and probably will stay in beta. I think my question that really keeps rattling around for me is a bigger one, and it is, you know, you guys know the first question I ask all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today? And I've been asking people that all over the world for the last 3 years, and a significant percentage of the time we ultimately end up with testing, right? Like, that is quite often we end up with, to boil it down into simplest terms, somehow testing, standardized testing, becomes the biggest problem facing education today. And I think in the US, we would probably agree with that. For most people, would say that's at least a big problem, if not the biggest. And I have not, cannot even tell you how many times people have said, I wish we could just eliminate the tests. And all of a sudden, in most places, we've eliminated the test. And this just happened overnight. And so what does education look like? Because as I've thought about it, as much as I don't like the tests, it informs a ton of the decision making. It informs the pay structures. It informs the funding model. It informs a lot of things. And going into 2020, 2021 school year, we won't have that data. That data will not be there. And so does it come to 2020 and 2021 and we just go, well, we're just going to have to do the best we can this year and everything's back to status quo next year? Or is there a real possibility that this could be the start of a wave of change? John, you want to kick us off on that one?
Yeah, I think you hit a huge topic. A lot of people have reached out to me and said, hey, how do I facilitate this test? Because, oh my gosh, my students can just look on another screen and find the answers. And I think I start to see a little bit of that light bulb of, oh my gosh, does this information really matter if I'm asking them questions they can Google? I think we've all kind of questioned, you know, that aspect of it. Or there's an app out there where the students can just scan a math problem and it spits out mm-hmm. every step and how to do it. And so I'm hoping that one thing that's coming out of this is we're starting to think about the kinds of ill-structured problems we really want our students to tackle, right? They need to have those foundational skills, but do they need a giant standardized test to do it? I mean, I think data is really important, but we have these great diagnostic tools where we can ask 10 to 12 questions and find out approximately using AI, like where they are, right? The AI can kind of tell us approximate levels, and then we can adjust accordingly what they need literacy math. Do we need to put them through hours because we're trying to use it to grade teachers or grade districts or things like that? I think there's great diagnostic tools that teachers maybe in this switch to digital are going to discover and utilize more to get that instantaneous data to make those decisions. Because I think the problem is we've been collecting the wrong data. We've been trying to capture these big picture data when really what we need is that student to student data to help inform our teachers. And we need to help our teachers be able to take action on it. So I'm hoping that maybe they realize, oh, we didn't need that data. Were we doing anything meaningful with it? It's more important that we give our teachers the skills and the tools to get the data that's going to make those moment to moment impacts. And then I guess circling back to my previous point is, I'm hoping we also realize that if you do an online or blended class, asking those basic level questions aren't really going to get it done in our instantaneous information world. We need to give them these challenging problems that ask them to use that foundational knowledge to solve ill-structured problems. So there's, I'll just get off my soapbox now. I'm just going to step down.
No, I think it's good. I think it's good. Yeah. I agree. I think I guess you're right. In a way we are forcing the light bulb, not only at a large scale of the testing's gone, now what do we do? But even at the teacher scale of, wait, I can't monitor to make sure they're not cheating. How do I do this? And I think you're right. There's going to be some forced light bulbs out of all this. Blair, anything to add?
Yeah, I guess, and this might sound overly optimistic, but when I first started teaching, assessments were still, like state assessments were still very much like, all right, we're going to teach you a test-taking strategy where you like look for a distractor and then you X that out and then you look for like XYZ. And since I've been teaching, like a lot of assessments that I've seen at the state level are ones where the level of rigor is a lot higher. Like it's a lot harder to teach students like a way to just do well on an assessment. Like when I taught in DC, the questions that students were asking, you couldn't Google. And I'm hopeful, and I guess maybe the piece that I think is missing is that the way that we have with a lot of teachers and districts that I've worked with, the way that we view assessments is still very much in that realm of, let's teach you the strategies to be able to like do good at tests. And I think that, you know, a good state assessment, if you're an excellent teacher and you are teaching kids what they need to know based on the, like using data from things like John mentioned, your students should do well on a state assessment, like a well-made state assessment. And there's a lot of questions and like valid concerns about like, is it a good state assessment? And I think some states are further along than others. But my hope is that, I guess I'm not like, I think state assessments have a place and can be useful. I think the quantity of assessments and the way that we teach to them is maybe the problem. And I'm hopeful that this shift is helping teachers, I guess, maybe removing the flawed ways that people have taught to assessments before. I think that could be like a big takeaway here. And the only concern I have there is that if your teacher has been teaching to an assessment and doing it in a poor way, and that all of a sudden goes away, what are you going to fall back on? And I think a lot of teachers don't have maybe the knowledge, skills, and mindsets that John mentioned to do that. And I know that that was kind of meandering, but I have a lot of thoughts and feelings about it. So, yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, I can only speak to my Florida context for the most part. So when I think about our state assessment, I don't exactly think of quality, high rigor content in general. You know, I think of a lot of issues mostly and the significant amount of time that is taken from instruction each year to do that. But yeah, I think, I'm not sure where to take that, Blair. You've got me a little stumped, man. I think the point you made is important at the end there, though, of without the test, what do some of these teachers fall back on, right? And I think that will, the answer to that question is what will make or break the long-term success and long-term consequences of all of this. You know, if teachers fall back on quality instructional practices that are rigorous, still online, but also lead to increased student learning, then we will be able to get the end of this and say, hey, look, we did just fine without the test. But if that's not what happens, and early metrics and early diagnostics in August and September of next year showed that there was a massive backslide in the student learning, you know, that's where the legislators are going to be coming in and be able to say, see, this is what happens when we don't have the test. And I think a lot of that is, you know, is scary to me, but potentially exciting, right? Interesting. Guys, this has been awesome. This is really cool. I can't believe we've already been going for like 45 minutes or 50 minutes or something like that. This has been awesome. Like, you guys got me thinking a lot. The last thing I want to talk about before we kind of wrap this thing up here is, the student and also parent experience is another thing I've been putting a lot of thought into. And again, thinking about future consequences, right? So if we now have basically 100% of students are going to be doing online web-based learning, in a lot of cases starting on Monday, then what does the parent and student experience look like? And I think about the funding side of this. So if this becomes an effective measure for 10, 15, 20% of students right now, and that 10, 15, 20% of students choose to go the online route when we go back in August because it was effective for them, that is going to have a massive and mostly detrimental effect on the system as we know it. You know, schools can't afford to lose 10 or 20% of their funding, even if they do lose 10 or 20% of their student population. And I'm concerned about that, but also on the flip side of it, I also feel like if that's what happens, then that is the modality that is best for those 10, 20% of students. So I'm torn by a lot of this. This is an idea that I'm not fully formed on at all in my head. But it's something that's bothering me and keeping me up at night right now is what does online learning look like and how effective does it work? And almost if we do it well, do we do ourselves a disservice in the long run?
Yeah, I can try to take a stab at that, that one. I think hopefully, if anything, you mentioned losing funding. I think hopefully districts, what they realize out of this, hopefully they, again, we talk about using data strategically. Hopefully districts are thinking about reaching out to parents, guardians, and students and getting a sense of if this modality did work for them, and then planning accordingly of whether they should shift resources into doing more blended or online through the district so they can maintain those students rather than the students leaving the district to go to maybe sometimes I know there's state sanctioned online schools or independent, you know, ones out there that are funded a variety of different ways. But districts themselves might need to be proactive on this and consider if they need to look at their current online or blended offerings and how they approach that to, you know, not lose that funding. And the number one cost it will be for the district is really, in my opinion, the teacher prep. Because as we've talked about on this podcast today, it is such a myriad of different things to consider. And I'm coming from a perspective of I've taken all of my graduate work fully online. I've taught online, and I still would call myself a novice just because you're constantly trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. And believe me, gentlemen, I have figured out a lot of what does not work. I could fill a warehouse with it, but it's very nuanced and challenging. But if they get the data back that says, yes, I would move to something like this in a number that moves the dial, they really need to look at their own practices and ask, how are we in-house going to maintain these students while still providing them this service that they think will work for them? So that would be my take is if they're worried about funding, then do something about it. You know, do something to serve these students because nobody's gonna cry for you if you lose funding because you let those students walk and didn't reach out and say, oh, I'm glad you like this medium. Here's what we've got. Or interesting, we will take this back to our people. You know, so this summer might be a time where districts need to get good data and then act on the data.
I like that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's already examples of that in like less of a crisis orientation. Like, you know, I grew up and fun fact, John and I are actually like very close geographically right now. So I grew up in Janesville, Wisconsin, and the school district that I graduated from launched a virtual school. Like, I don't know at what point, but I see billboard advertisements for it when I drive to my grandma's house. And, you know, that is a good example of, and not like, I have strong opinions about like for-profit virtual schools. So like, I would much rather have a student attend like Janesville School District Virtual Academy versus like Wisconsin Virtual Academy by K-12 Learning. Like, I would rather them stay in district and that funding and access to extracurricular activities and like as needed in-person opportunities exist and are familiar. So I'm hoping that folks can take that, it's already existing in many districts, but take that and scale it up. So totally in agreement with John there. And also like one of the things we sent a survey to the teachers at my school in Phoenix. And one of the things we asked was, like, first of all, like, what are your thoughts on this model? Because it's, you know, there's a lot going on that's different. And thinking about next year, what could you implement? Like, what could you take from this and implement next year when we're back, like, knock on wood, like, we're back in the regular world. So I'm hoping that, like, both of those, because you have folks who are going to be very much like, yes, I want to blow up the model. And as a student, like, I want to blow up the model and do this. And you're probably going to have a lot of folks who are like, I like both. And how can you take the best of both of these for this, for the many students who come back, but probably saw some value in the virtual model?
Yeah, I think, you know, sort of wrapping that up there, it's from both of you guys. It's what, instead of being afraid of what this looks like, instead, what can we learn from this experience? You know, not only, because even though we are trying to do this on the fly, and a lot of us are going to make a lot of mistakes, we're going to try a lot of things, and some of them it's going to work. And some of these experiences and activities and things you try right now are going to work when you get back to a model that is still in person in August, September, assuming we get to that point. You know, I think, yeah, I like that. It's a much more positive spin than I think I was headed in my head. So good job, guys. You guys are good. You guys balance me out quite nicely. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I think Blair, you know, to his point about some districts are already doing this, if any district is worried about it and moving forward and expanding what they've got, they now have hundreds, if not thousands, of teacher examples of online attempts that they can learn from and empower and say what teachers, you know, had aspects of the switched online that they like to inform how they move forward. So I think there's incredible possibilities. I think it's an exciting time for a district who wants to expand on this because they've got all these use cases of what landed, what flopped, and they can use that to inform their practice. So you want to talk about, you know, information that you can move forward on. There's tons out on it. And now is the time if they were ever tentative about doing it because they had to.
Now, I like that. Now is the time because you have to. I think that's kind of where we all stand right now. That's a pretty solid place to leave it there. Guys, I appreciate you so much for joining me and having this conversation with me. I think there's a lot of great information in here for my audience and people thinking about this distance learning thing. So I really appreciate that. Just before we wrap it up, of course, how can my audience get a hold of you guys if they have any additional questions? We'll go to Blair first because John introduced himself first, and that just seems fair.
Yeah, well, I've posted on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Like, I do consulting work, but right now I am more than happy to talk to any district or school, charter district, what have you, just for a free call to be like, hi, how's it going? Like, what are your plans? What do you need help with? So my website is Blair Blur. That's BlairBlur.com. I'm on Twitter at Blair the Blur as well. And I'm also on LinkedIn. I love connecting with folks, especially now since I'm stuck with my family. So please, someone engage with me. I'd really appreciate it.
All right. Awesome. John?
Yeah. Best place is definitely Twitter. So I'm at Jonathan Spike. Just changed my Twitter handle to better reflect my name. But you guys can call me John or Spike. Feel free. Don't have to do the formal Jonathan. And then I do have a website. It's called gamestormedu.com. If you're interested in helping your students or you build an educational game, I think it'd be a great activity right now during, you know, kind of our quarantine period, you know, challenge students to build a board or card game as one of their, maybe their playlist activity. They're bringing it back to what Blair talked about. But yeah, those are two great ways to get a hold of me. I'm happy to chat with you on Twitter. So feel free to reach out. And I look forward to seeing how this shift to online and digital goes.
Awesome. Well, guys, again, thank you so much for joining me. This was so much fun. I know this is, you know, that split of this national worldwide tragedy is striking everyone. And yet for education, it kind of has this positive light and positive possibility to it. So I appreciate you guys sitting through this with me and talking it out and giving some great ideas. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Brad.
Yeah, thanks so much.
John and Blair, thank you guys so much for joining me on the show and discussing this obviously relevant topic. You both gave some awesome insight, and I think my listeners will get a lot out of it. To connect with John, find him on Twitter at Jonathan Spike, or at his website, gamestormedu.com. Or you can find Blair on Twitter at BlairTheBlur, or at his website, BlairBlur.com. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram at Brad Schreffler. I'd love to hear from you guys there, and that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or check out the feedback page on my website that gives you additional options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, try to build community in your online classroom.
Music for the Planning Period Podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.org. The Planning Period Podcast is a proud member of the On Podcast Media Network. You can hear other great shows by hosts such as Mike Washburn, Glenn Irvin, Dan Crinus, and many more by visiting onpodcastmedia.com. The Planning Period Podcast is also a member of the VoiceEd Radio Network. You can hear this show and tons more, including regular live interviews about education, at voiceed.ca. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.